And let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Lorenzo. Right on.
I'm Lorenzo Alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here. So I'm in town and just got done with a meeting Monday afternoon, and I get a phone call, and I look and I see, oh, it's my sponsor Ramon. I better answer this one. And he's, hey, what are you going to be doing Friday? I'm going to be speaking in Tulare, and I want you to be my 10-minute speaker. And just like my third time, I get blessed to be the 10-minute speaker. And you don't tell your sponsor no. So I just said, yeah, without any questions of asking him what fellowship or anything. I just said, okay. And he said, okay, we got it. And a couple days went by, and I'm like, is this going to be AA? Is this going to be NA? Is this going to be in English? Is it going to be in Spanish? And I'm like, I called him up, and I called him, and I asked him. And then he told me, no, it's AA, it's going to be in English. I'm like, oh, okay. Because I speak Spanish, I'm bilingual, but still, I'm more comfortable speaking English. Anyways, for me, I was born into alcoholism. You know, I was born in July of 1962. And when my mom was pregnant, she didn't know she was pregnant with me. And in 1962, they didn't know much about alcohol fetal syndrome. You know, so I was born an alcoholic. But they didn't know nothing about this till maybe a decade later. They start doing studies about all that. Well, anyways, when I was 3 years old, my mom and my dad separated. And my mom didn't want anything to do with me and my two younger brothers. So I went to go live with my dad and his parents, my paternal grandparents. And that's where I grew up. And my grandpa was an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. My uncles were alcoholics. I grew up in East Porterville, and all my neighborhood, everybody drank. You know, and growing up, I would see the craziness that comes with alcoholism. You know, my dad and his buddies drinking and fighting and going to jail. And the whole neighborhood was like that. Every holiday, birthdays, funerals, everything was, alcohol was always around, you know. And growing up, I thought that was normal. That was normal for every family. Then I got a little older, and I'm like going to visit with other friends and their families and stuff. And I'm like, man, they're not like my family. I'm like, my family's not normal. My friends, my neighbors, man. You know, so I grew up in that kind of atmosphere, thinking alcohol and all the behaviors were normal. You know, and I didn't really start drinking until I got into, like, my junior year in high school. I got into sports. Because my first freshman and sophomore year, I was getting in trouble, barely making it in school. And my counselor told me, if you want to straighten up, get into sports. So I did. And that really helped me. But another thing opposite that went with that is after all the football games and wrestling matches and track, we'd get together and we'd go drink. You know, the guys and the girls. The girls' basketball team, softball team, we all drank. You know, and that's the way I started my alcoholism, my first blackouts, and it continued like that. And when I graduated high school, I'm the only one out of 8 kids that graduated. And right out of high school, I started working with the Forest Service as a seasonal firefighter, because that's what my grandpa did and that's what my dad did. So they had the connections, and I got right into it, you know. And it was really, really good work, really rewarding. I always had a good work ethic from my grandparents, but every time we'd get called, we're like at home, and they'd call us at the house. During summertime, we could be at the lake getting drunk. We could be anywhere, and they'd call us, hey, you got to be at the warehouse. We're going to go out to a fire. and we'd all show up, half of us all drunk, you know, and that's the way it went. And after a while, it was okay at first, and then the trouble started coming, doing dumb things, drinking and going to jail and prison and other stuff that comes with the behavior. And it got to the point where I traded that career with the Forest Service for a career as an alcoholic and also an addict, you know. But alcohol has always been my first thing, my drug of choice, because I loved it. I still love it to right now. And the first thing I would do after coming out of a program or jail, that first beer, that first one. And I would do good in the program, and I would commit and promise that I was going to be okay. I wasn't going to drink that first one, and I was going to do it. But something happened right when I got out. Had a little bit of money, and there it goes. That first drink, and that was what it took, and it was downhill. And it took me a long time to get it. And part of my story is, like, my three worst bottoms all revolved around death in my family. You know, I was locked up in Bob Wiley's in 1996, and my grandma who raised me, she passed, and I didn't even know. Nobody in my family let me know. So one of my friends that I grew up with came in, Bob Wiley's, and, oh, sorry about your grandmother. I'm like, what? Well, she's been dead and buried for like a month already. I'm like, man, that was pretty rough. But instead of doing anything, like wanting to quit, I just got out and I drank more, you know. And it happened again. And 2004, I was in prison. They called me to the lieutenant's office, and they said, we had a call from the Tulare County Sheriff. So I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, you know Lawrence Flores? I go, yeah, that's my dad. They go, well, he passed. And I'm like, I go, who called my family? He goes, no, nobody from your family. The sheriff's called the prison to let me know. My family didn't let me know anything, you know. That was really, really, really tough. Because I was in prison, I couldn't medicate. And then my worst bottom, I was in the 50th anniversary of bombing of Pearl Harbor, which was on December 7th, 2012, I got arrested. And that next Saturday, I was in the holding tank detoxing alcohol and my other things that I did. And I get a call to the bars, and they say, you need to call home right now. So I called home, and my brother answered. I go, what's going on, bro? And he goes, they got me in my room under house arrest. I'm like, what? And he told me, my nephew, Hector, he goes, Hector killed my two brothers and my sister. I'm like, what? And I'm just like, man. He goes, yeah. And my mom wasn't home. My mom was at a elders dinner for the elders from the Tule River Indian Reservation where I lived at, in Table Mountain. So she wasn't home, which is a good thing. And I'm just like, all right, bro, let me know what happens. And I just hung up the phone, and I'm like, my heart just dropped, you know. It was the worst heartache I've ever felt in my life. I was stuck in jail. I couldn't drink. I couldn't do no drugs. I couldn't numb the sadness. I couldn't do anything. I was just like, I was just there. And it felt like something did die inside of me right then. And I'm like, man. And then the 10 o'clock news came out, and it's the first thing that they show. Murder on the Mountain, they were calling it. And this person killed three of his family members. And he ended up taking off on my brother's car with his two girls. He had shot his son, but his son lived. And he had his two daughters in the car. And he got pulled over by Lindsay. And he shot the two girls, and then he shot at the cops, and then he shot himself. And that's when it ended, you know. And the sheriff was telling me all this. I'm like, man. And I ended up doing a violation. I did 30 days, and by the, when I came out, all the services were all done. And the first thing I did was get drunk, blackout drunk, for like 3 weeks until I went back again, because I was on parole and probation. And I, at the time, I didn't realize it, but I was so heartbroken, I wanted to die. I was trying to commit suicide by drinking and drugging, you know. That's how heartbroken I was. And then I would also use the excuse from my sorrows and my sadness, poor me, to get women to go home with me, get more drugs, get more alcohol. I played it to the hilt. Poor me, you know. And of course, I ended up going back. And then I didn't want to stop. I did not want to stop. And then finally, on July 9th, 2012, the last time I got arrested, because they always catch you. And I was always on the run. I was always on probation. I was always on parole. And I always had something on me that I wasn't supposed to. And the Porterville PD already knew me. So whenever they see me, they go, oh, we got one there. And sure enough, they got me. On July 9th, 2012, I got caught. And they had me do this program, RSAT, for the third time. And they didn't want to let me do it, but they gave me the last chance. And this time, after I had 30 days already in, that you get that moment of clarity. And I'm like, man, I was going to be 50 years old on July 22nd, 2012. And I'm like, I'm 50 years old. I need to grow up. I need to grow up. At 50 years old, I was saying I had to grow up. You know? And I knew that I didn't stop what I was doing, I was going to die. I should have died. Should have been dead a bunch of times. So I had that moment of clarity, and on my top bunk, I surrendered to my higher power. I go, you know what? I cannot do it. I used to think I could do it. If I wanted to quit, I could quit anytime. No, I couldn't. So I did something that I never wanted to do all the other times. I go, I want to do recovery. I want to stay sober. Never in them other times I wanted to do that. Fake it to make it. But this last time I'm like, no, I got to do it. I have to do it for my mom who's still around. I have to do it for my brother and sister who are around. I have to do it for the ones that got murdered. For them, to honor them, I got to stay sober. And that's what was my driving force when I first got out. And I had to pray every day, them 6.5 months in there, for my higher power to take that temptation when I got out. But I was good in there. But once I got out, we get a little bit of money every month from our casino, and I had like 6-7 months built up, and that was enough to kill me. I already knew that. I told my higher power every day, take that temptation from that first one. Please take that temptation from that first one. Like our reason says, one is too many. When I got out, I had to do a drug court program, so I knew I was going to have to behave, which I was grateful for. It saved my life. But I had to do the footwork, and I dedicated my life to stay sober for my loved ones. That's what I first used. I did it a little bit for myself, but more for them. So I could honor them by that. Because my oldest brother that died, me and him used to be really, really close. We do everything together. And once I went back out, he like disowned me. And that really hurt, you know. So to make amends to them and my other sister and brother, I go, I'm gonna clean up and stay sober. So that's what I did. And then not till later, I was doing it for myself. You know, and took suggestions, got the sponsor, meetings, I do meetings in both fellowships. But AA, you know, I love it because my first drug of choice is alcohol. And alcohol leads me to everything else. You know, and this program has saved me. I got a little support group here from Porterville who I love. They're my family. And all of you in these rooms are my family. You know, I got my sponsor here. I got my mentor, old Spring Chicken Jim back there. You know? Who I call on all the time, because I'm going through some ugly stuff right now. Right now I got a sister who's in her addiction really ugly. She brings all that junk at home. My mom had a big stroke a couple months ago, and I got a brother who's paralyzed, and I'm the one that has to step up. And sometimes it could be overwhelming, you know. I got to help my mom fill out papers because she's legally blind now. And I got to help my brother out. And sometimes I'm like, man. And then I'll call my sponsor. I'll text Jim, and he'll send me a text. Powerless. He always has the right things for me. People in the fellowship are always there for me, you know. And I've learned to share everything that I have, to leave it. If not, it's going to kill me. It just, man, it makes me go nuts. And I have to share it, you know. And but there's a lot of good stuff that's happened also, you know. I used to have Hep C. I was blessed with medication to take that away. I qualified for a 12-week treatment. My first blood work in 6 weeks, my Hep C was gone, you know. And but I also knew that to stay healthy, I had to not drink no more. I couldn't do anything no more, and I knew it. And I know it's a lifetime thing. And for me, coming to meetings and being around people like my cousin over there, he's got over 3 decades doing meetings, and that's what I love. I love the people in these rooms. I had to change my whole life around how I used to chase my alcoholism. I have to chase my recovery. You know? I volunteer. I do H&I in Mountain Home. I was blessed to go up there a couple months now, and I love it. It's bringing the message of hope from someone that's been in there with them, should have been in an orange jumpsuit like they are. I get to share the message of hope that they can come out and do something positive, you know. And this gentleman here, Albert, I love the guy. He was one of my counselors in RSTEP, and I've learned a lot from him, and I still remember things he used to share, little sayings, and I share them now when I speak. He always used to say, if you run with dogs, you're going to get fleas. And people hear that, I'm like, man, it's so true. I love that. I love that. That's what keeps me going, stuff like that. The readings, I love the readings, you know. It's what the fellowship is about, you know. And I also heard a gentleman share, when we share our joy and our happiness, our joy and happiness grows, because I share it with you. And we share our pain and hurt and sorrow and lessons, because you guys carry that with you guys too. You know, and I'm grateful for Ramon for inviting me to speak, and I'm grateful to be here. And with that, I'll keep coming back. Thank you.
Gentlemen, you take your seats. I'd really appreciate it. Okay, let's give a rousing Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Ramon Valos.
Ah, yeah. It's a good level, brother. Yeah, thank you. Good night, everyone. Why don't you say not everyone? Family. Good night, family. My name is Ramon, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, I'm sober today. And I'm right where I'm supposed to be at this moment. I thank this group for inviting me. I couldn't say no. I've learned that at the beginning. When they asked me, are you willing to go to any length? And I said, yes. When you get as sick and tired as I did, I was willing to do anything. I need to go back a little bit about my history, where I came from, what it was like. I grew up in El Paso, Texas. I was a 12-year-old kid when I first took my first drink. And at that moment, the effect it had was like a release, like a peace, like a calmness. I felt really, really super good. But then, if a little bit is good, give me some more of that stuff. And they used those big kawama, those big bottles, and you know, the quartz. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Texas, everything's big. Yeah, those big old... Instead of, the cans, we use those all the time. So give me some more of that stuff. Until I started throwing up. I got super sick. But I like the effect. You know, that effect... An alcoholic knows what I'm talking about. That feeling of, wow. You know, I heard of a story of this chronic alcoholic. He didn't want to stop drinking. He finally gave up and says, you know what, I don't forget everything else, but I want to continue drinking. I just have one wish. When I die... take my brain out and put it in a jar of alcohol. And so, yeah, sure enough, a few months later, he died. And, yeah, they did what he wished. They put his brain in an alcohol jar. And when they put it there, there was a sound that came out. That sound, that feeling, that's what I loved about alcohol. That first feeling, man, I loved it, and I pursue it. It almost killed me. And I still wanted to find that again. The third chapter talks about me. That's me. Right at the beginning of the chapter, man. Yeah. I did not want to admit I was an alcoholic. That was a dirty word to me, man. It was insulting. How dare people think I'm an alcoholic? You guys are crazy. See, I had the wrong concept. Then plus, I didn't know this, but I resisted, I fought, because I wanted to continue drinking. I was after that feeling. So, I continued drinking. More and more. And then it was real easy to me get a hold of alcohol. Because all I had to do was just go across the border. And I could buy tequila. Tequila. It didn't take those big old bottles anymore. Just a few shots will do the job. You know? I ended up in jail in Mexico and throwing up in the jail cell, was a hole in the middle of the room. That's it. That was the restroom right there, the hole. No toilet. That was it. But I continued drinking and moved to California, 1970. It was a hippie era. The hippie era. A lot of wine, let me tell you. I started with, the sweet kind, you know, the Ripple, the Spaniada, and all that stuff, you know. This is like table wine. This is okay. I ended up with Thunderbird.
Yeah.
I started drinking I thought it was the finest wines. It was okay to drink. Thunderbird, man. White port. Oh, I think about that today, man. Who knows? That might have saved my life. Until I got here. Looking back, I had all the isms already. Very angry little kid. A lot of anger. Irritable, discontent. It seemed like there was something missing in my life. There was a hollow, something inside of me. And I thought that's the way I was going to fill that void that I felt inside. I thought, okay, from outside in, to fill that void. I felt apart from all the time. That's why today, anywhere I go to an AA meeting, and I feel like I'm at home. I feel like a family. You know what? And this is what I've always wanted. I've always wanted to be a part of. But I didn't know at that time. That's what I wanted. I needed that love that's in these rooms. I continued drinking, got married. And I know that my drinking started more and more. It started, you know, I could drink day and night. And I used to brag about it. I thought I was Superman. Because the cops would stop me, and I could pass their test. At that time, they didn't have no breathalyzer. Well, they didn't. It's been a while. You know, I shouldn't be embarrassed about my age, huh? No. This is who I am, man. Yeah. They didn't have those breathalyzers. So they put you, okay, pass your nose and this and that and whatever, look at this. And I would pass the test. I was all drunk, drinking all night, and I would pass that test, man. So guess what it did to my ego? Chingon, man. The cops can, you know, even mess with me, man. See, it's like, hey, I'm, you know that, it built me up.
Yeah.
To be able to get away, you know, from them. And there was a few times I ran away from them, too. And they didn't catch me. And I think it felt good, too, not to get caught. I don't want to spend too much of my drinking, but I used to let you know that, you know, I really had quite a problem with alcohol. That's looking today, looking back. At that time, there's no way that I had a problem. I always had that idea, that obsession, that this time I'm going to drink only one or two. And I'm going to enjoy those one or two. That was my mentality. I went through four different recovery homes. And each time, while I was sober, I was, you know, and it felt good. I was able to, my mind was clear, and I really wanted it. I really thought that I had it. You know, I had it. This time I got it, man. I know I got it, man. I mean well, man. But before long, I was with a bottle again in my hand. I would question, why the heck did I get here again? After so many promises, especially to myself, man, to my loved ones. And there I was again. How did it happen? What went wrong? And at that moment, I didn't know what went wrong. I just knew that I was drinking again. And I said, well, I'm already drinking, so might as well just booze it up. Bring me some more. Let's go get some more. I blew it already, so what, you know? After quite a few DUIs, a lot of accidents, and a lot of, I got married, a lot of conflict, a lot of fights, you know, with the wife, and with three beautiful young babies, you know, at that time. Good job, lost the job, the separations, and you know all that stuff that goes along with an alcoholic like me. Finally, you know, a lot of things have happened in my life. I used to call coincidences. But somehow, I ended up in L.A. See, I had gone through L.A. I had gone through Raleigh Hills. I had gone through Care Unit in Madera. Raleigh Hills in Newport Beach. I had gone through Power Center twice. And this time, I ended up in L.A. And I didn't know this, but there was an alcoholic in the home. And he was attending AA meetings. How did I get there? I mean, I didn't make a decision. Okay, this is where I'm going to go. Because I plan to start going to meetings. And that wasn't my plan. I didn't even know. No, they just shipped me to LA. They put me in a Greyhound bus and take off. As much as we love you, you cannot stay here anymore. All the doors were closed, man. Not even my family wanted me around. By this time, I had drank my mom up. That was a tough one, man. Because she was the last one to go. She would not give up on me. Whenever I was at the hospital, whenever I was in jail, guess who showed up? Mom would be the only one that would show up. Hey, what's up with the homeboys? What's up with the friends, the drinking buddies? They didn't show up. So anyway, by this time, Mom had gone by, had gone, passed on already. So my oldest sister kind of took the role of the mom, and she's the one that told me, you cannot stay here no more. Man, it seemed like, wow, like a big old rock just crushed me, man. That's it. It's like, you've done it. You've done it, Ramon. So I ended up in L.A. I still drank a couple of months. You know how I found my way. My sister, I would ask her for money the first few days so I can buy a pack of cigarettes. So at first, okay, yeah, here you go. But then after a week or so, she wouldn't give me no more money for cigarettes. Because I would not buy cigarettes. I would go buy me a bottle of wine. So she had cigarettes already. She went and bought the cigarettes. Whenever I asked her money for cigarettes, she would give me a pack of cigarettes. That pissed me off, man. I resentment, man. I resented her. How dare she does this, you know? Man, how mean is she? Doesn't she know what I'm going through? No, she didn't. We're suffering. Doesn't she know? Where's all this compassion stuff, man, you know? So finally, you know, she wouldn't give me no more money. And then the workers, my brother-in-law had a crew, and some of them would drink. So I started to go, these guys drink, man. I could tell. So I would go try to get a drink from them or borrow money from them. But then my brother-in-law says, if any one of you give Ramon some money or give him a drink or something, you're fired. So man. So I still managed to get out of there. I borrowed her car one time. I totaled that car, man. I went and got drunk and totaled it. Thank God the cops didn't show up. In L.A., man, there's a lot of traffic. Well, you shouldn't take two cars, man. You know, I guess the other guy didn't have a license either or something, you know. So we decided, hey, I told him, you know, I got all drunk. You know what? Hey, it's okay, man. You fix your car, we fix ours. Okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And then we had a little kid, my friend's baby. He got, it was all cut, bleeding. So the other guy got scared too. Hey, yeah, let's take off, man. So we took off. Anyway, December 31st. 1984. That's a special day for me. We were there at the house. I was in my little room. I didn't want to socialize with anybody, man. I just asked my sister for a favor. Man, just buy me a little bottle. A little bottle. Half a pint. Oh, excuse me. Half a pint. I get a little excited every now and then. Man. Half a pint. Only half a pint, man. It's not going to do nothing. So okay, I convinced her, and she bought me a little half a pint of whiskey and a pack of cigarettes. Okay, so there I was in my little room, you know, and I could hear the commotion outside. Everybody was screaming and yelling and cumbia music and everything out there, man. They were waiting for the new year. And there I was, all miserable. I was miserable, man. I was just thinking about my kids, my babies at that time. You know, I grew up without a father, so if someone of you can identify with that, I did not want, even though I was a drunk, but I did not want my kids to go through what I went through, for whatever reason. See, I think that was it, because living like a lifestyle like that without a father, without a father figure, so I deep inside, I didn't want my kids to go through that. So that was tearing me apart, man. So I was there, and then all of a sudden, you know, I wasn't drunk either. I was not drunk. I was in that room, and I heard like a gush of wind. Shh. And then the door opened, and that wind came in, and then the door closed. And as soon as it closed, the room lit up. I mean, LED lighting, bro. LED light. Bright white light, man, in that room. Bright white. I seen that light a few times, two, three times in my sobriety. And then a voice. Ramon, look what you've done with your life. And this is like a tape. I started seeing like scenes, it was videotape, like a videotape. Was I going nuts, brother? I seen videotape. I talked to Albert today, and he asked, "Hey, are you coming over, man?" And he's like, Well, and that commitment, man. And they said, well, we should be committed. We should have been committed to the asylum. Well, yeah, by the grace of God, we were not, brother. Yeah. And that boy's, look what you've done with your life. And then I see myself as a black dog, a colored black dog, without an owner. Running the streets, man. No food, nowhere to go. So that scene passed, and then I see myself with a shovel. I was digging and digging and digging and digging. And then finally, I got tired and I looked up. And it was so deep, I couldn't get out no more. You are digging your own grave. Then all of a sudden, man, I just broke down like a little baby. All that stuff that I held for so many years, man, it just came out. Start crying, and I mean, uncontrollably. You're like, ah! Practically nobody was in that room, and just me. See, I knew the seed had been planted already. So I said, I'm tired. I'm sick and tired of living like this. I don't want to live like this no more. See that? Now, this is the key right here. Then I said, but I cannot do it by myself. I need you. I need you. I cannot do it alone. And from there on, 34 years have gone by. I haven't had to take another drink. And it's all by the grace of God. There's no doubt about that. So, I remember attending my first AA meeting in Bell Gardens. I got up on the podium. And I shared, I remember that I shared, I was really hurting. He says, you know what? This time, I really blew it. I lost my kids. After the meeting, someone came to me. And he says, he asks me, what do you mean you lost your kids? Are they dead? I said, no, they're not dead. Okay, you have not lost your kids. And he went like that to me, man. You have not lost your kids. What you need to do right now, you need to get your act together, man. Because if you're not good for you, you're not going to be good for those kids either. Man, I got angry. It's like a bucket of cold water. What the heck, man? Today, I know why I got angry. I needed to hear that. Wasn't that the truth? Those words, man, they're still fresh. They're still fresh. They're written. See, that's why I love this program, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, because we practice the language of the heart. That's how this program works, man. For so many years, I questioned, and I tried to get something to explanations and this and that. How does this work? I come into the program, and they tell me, you need to call your sponsor. Oh, I asked my sponsor. Hey, would you like to be my sponsor? My first sponsor. And he says, you know what, I'll be your sponsor, but only one condition, he says. You call me every day. Yes, what I thought about that. This guy is full. How in the heck is this going to help me? Calling him every day. How does it make sense? This guy's not. He's cheaper than me, you know. I should be his sponsor. That kind of mentality, man, you know. I was different, man. I was better then, right? I mean, I was, man, without a home, homeless, and no place to stay, I was better then. Man. But you know what? I was, as I had said before, are you willing to go to any length? It's okay, I'll call you. Just to get him off my back. Man, thank God for that sponsor, man. Because I was so selfish, so self-centered, man. I didn't, so self-sufficient, so I thought. That little practice, picking up that phone, that telephone therapy, huh? Picking up that phone, man, and calling, even just to say, hi, I'm doing okay. Practice. I know how valuable that was. You know, and today, I try to pass that on to my sponsors. They kick me off the curb. No? Okay. You guys are missing out. You guys are missing out, man. But that's how my ego was so inflated, man. That's how I developed that, I guess, humility. I know I shouldn't express it that much, but just show it better, huh? But doing that, it was helping me to be obedient. Because before, I didn't obey nobody. It was what I said, what I thought, what I wanted. And if it was different, it's my way. Very, very rebellious. That was my attitude since a little kid, man. Growing up without a father, no one to answer to, no one to guide me. So I had, you know, it was difficult for me. So that helped me. And I started staying sober. And then at first it was like I was in cloud nine, man. Man, I'm sober, man. The first few months. Then shit hit the fan. I came home and I said, you know what? About 9 months. Man, I think I got this program all right, man. I'm going to see if we can work things out with my ex-wife. Then I can get back to my kids, man. I want to be with my kids. My wife was already out there partying here and there and this and that, you know. Just what I was doing, same thing I was doing. But except when she was doing it, I didn't like it. But when I was doing it, it was okay. So I had to learn. Learn the hard way. And it wasn't pleasant either. So I came back. You know, at first, man, I could see. I would come to meetings and well, she was drinking still. She was going to bars and this and that. Then it was me going and get her out of the bars. Oh, my goodness. Before it was her going and get me out of the bars. Now it's me doing that. See how things turn around? These are lessons that I had to go through to learn. So she kept on drinking. You know, it got to a point where, like, I would go to a meeting and I would listen to something, and as I was listening, man, she should be here, man. Man, she should be hearing this. This is good. She should have heard this. See? Oh, this would be good for her. See, I was just thinking about what she needed instead of what I needed. My focus was what she needed. She's the one that needed to change. So I would go home with a good, I was all excited, man, and feeling good, man, on cloud nine, happy. I was finally, bro, I was learning to be happy. It felt good. So I go home, and I see her. Man, she was sour, bro. She was resentful. And I would bring tapes that Mike used to record. The little cassettes. And I put it in so she could hear the message. She would pass me out. Shut that thing off, man. Shut it off. And what, man? She didn't like what I was, you know. I was imposing on her. I wanted her to get the program. But I forgot that the program was for me, not for her. It didn't work too well. Finally, she started resenting me because she was miserable. I used to talk to my sponsor. She was miserable. When she seen me happy, she resented me. And she told me a few times, one of these days, you this and that, I'm going to kill you. When you're asleep, I'm going to kill you. And she attempted it. Yeah. As a matter of fact, when I fight, you know what it took? I mean, so many back and forth trying to make it and this and that. I didn't want to let go. Hey, I'm married by the Catholic Church. We can't separate this and that. Finally, I came from work. She was drinking and my kids were there. And I showed up and I was eating. Then she shows up with a big old knife and she was drunk. She started crying, wanting to stab me. Oh, just like that, out of nowhere. And my kids were panicked. They were screaming. They were panicked. They were traumatized, man. Now I can see afterwards, I seen the results of all that, man. All that harm that we did to those kids, man. I remember my son. Daddy, he was 5 years old. When the little boy, Daddy, please go. I heard those words, man, just like when I had sobered up, man. It just impacted me. It's like I knew that was the end of it, that I was out of their house for good. I knew it. Oh, okay, so I just grabbed my little bag. Okay, you stay here with the kids, and I'm gone. And you know what? And today, it was awesome to see my friend of mine. Well, he was part of my recovery at that time. See, this is what I call a coincidence. The next day, I walked out of the house. There was a house, but they're in Portugal. Well, I think there was about 5 alcoholics living in that home. And just that day, one of the guys took off. So I walked right in. Like it was specially tailored. It was designed for me. I didn't plan that. It was there. Perfect timing. How perfect can it get? I couldn't have gotten that perfect. No matter how much I would have planned it. So today, I'm learning to plan, but not plan the outcome. Now today, when I plan, I ask for help to plan. Because I know who is in control of my life. But little picking up that phone, calling. Today, I've learned that obedience is better than sacrifice. I used to think, if I do this, but man, I was a go-getter, man. I had to stop, man, because now I can hardly walk. But before, man, I was running around all over the place. Non-stop, man. I was hyper to the max. So, man, my story is pretty long. But to make it kind of shorten it, after a while, I kept on and on. I stayed with you guys. I continued. That home was like a family. We all go home. In the evening, we go to a meeting. And after the meeting, we go to another meeting at Perkos or Denny's. And we did that for quite a while. I mean, at that time, I was still kind of a little energetic. 12 o'clock, man, come. We'd still be at Perkos, drinking coffee and another meeting, man, an awesome meeting. You know, a meeting after the meeting. Next day, go to work. And same thing again, meeting and after meeting. Work, work, work. The kids that were traumatized. My oldest daughter, my son, alcoholic addicts. And I got custody of them. Can you believe that? I got custody. AA helped me to learn to be a parent. Not only a father. I didn't know how to be a father. But I improved in that area how to be a father. And I had to play the role of a mother too. And I learned that role. Because I was so dependent on my wife, man. She was like a mother to me, man. Now I suffer a lot of abandonment issues, man. A lot of rejection. So I looked for a female that was like a mom to me. And if she wasn't, I'd make her a mom. I made sure that I trained her well. So I have to go through the process, man. If any of you are parents and have gone through something like that, you know that it's not an easy thing to do. Why? What a lesson. I said, man, now I know what my mom used to go through. Now I know, because I lived it, I'm living it, having to go to Corcoran State Prison, having to go quite a few times, having to go to court hearings, where they want to sentence my son to 25 to life, and this and that, and my son carrying guns, carrying crime, doing all that crap that goes along with, with a disease. I remember my daughter was 16 years old and she ran away. For a few nights, it was very difficult for me to fall asleep. You know what would come to mind? Man, what if this, I mean, I'm seeing, it's like, wow, what if... this happens. What if she's murdered? What if she's raped? What if she was a drug addict too. She was all over the place. She ran away. I did not know anything about her for about a month. I went to the police. I went and reported her missing and this and that. Nowhere to be found for about a month. One thing that I learned, though, I could come to you guys. I could come to you and tell you, express what I was going through. I remember someone coming to me and telling me, Ramon, the best that you can do. Not the only thing, the best that you can do is pray for her. You have no power. No matter where you go right now, try to find her, you're not gonna find her. You're powerless. Just like you were powerless over alcohol. Same thing. I started praying. You know, and after a while, something began to happen. I began to experience a peace within me. I was able to fall asleep like a little baby. And it didn't feel, then, oh, it felt good, but it didn't feel good. But then, my mind started telling me, man, don't you care anymore about your daughter? What's up with you? What's wrong with you? See, I couldn't accept that. I didn't know how to accept those blessings. But I had not experienced them before as deep. I still wanted to reject those blessings. Because I thought that I didn't deserve that. So I go back to the meeting and I share, you know what, this is going on. I'm feeling guilty. I'm at peace, but I'm feeling guilty. I'm starting to think that I don't care for my daughter no more. Once again, man, my God uses people to help me. He's always used people to help me. It's okay, Ramon. But you know what's happening? What's happening is that you're learning to let go. God is working on your behalf. It's okay. Receive it. Don't reject it. Receive it. Oh, okay. She came back alive, except one went away and two came back. She had a little baby already, well, in her womb. Mm-hmm. But it's okay. When I seen her, you know, and it was at an intersection. I was driving, and then all of a sudden she was driving too, and we met it right at the intersection. She seen me, and I seen her. We had to get off the cars, man. I got off and she got off. We embraced. We cried. I was just so happy to know that she was alive. I didn't care if she had gained quite a few pounds. I did not care. I was just blessed. I was so happy to see her. Ah, man, I'm going over. Today, my life, man, I'm living a good life today. I'm so blessed to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, man. Both of my kids, they're the best. My kids are the best. Now, they're training their kids. Now my grandchildren are living differently than I lived, than my kids lived. So it's like a domino effect. New seeds are being planted. Good things are happening in my life today. Both of my kids, they're almost 15 years in recovery. And it was a double miracle. If you believe that, it happened in my life about a month apart. Both my son and my daughter got sober. I said, man, a double portion. A double. And you know what? Me and my brother was another double portion miracle too. About a month apart too. He's younger, 10 years younger. But we both sobered up a month apart. And guess what? The same thing was repeated with my son and my daughter. So you know what? This program is a program of miracles. We get to see them. Life or death. Life, what do you want, Ramon? I tell my sponsors, what do you want? Take a pick. You want life or you want death? Simple. Today, I want life. I want life. And with that, you know, I thank you once again for allowing me to be here today. You know, I was a little nervous, but you know what? That's okay. You know what? If I don't get nervous, I know there's something wrong. Because when that little nervousness helps me to know that Ramon is not in control. Ramon, you're not in control. When you try to get in control, when you try to run the show, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. So this helps me to reach out and remember who's in control. And thank you once again for letting me share. God bless you.